Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Libertarian Talk Radio. This is your host, Austin Rayner. You're listening to WCWM 90.9 FM, Williamsburg, Virginia. You can also stream online at WCWM.org. Today, we're going to have a guest on the show, David Murata, president of Murata Wealth Management in Charlottesville. He's a financial advisor, and he also writes columns for the local newspaper, The Daily Progress, political columns. So today on the show, he's going to be speaking about inflation and its effect on personal portfolios, as well as increased taxation and what you can do to shield your assets from the negative effects of these governmental policies. So here he is. Mr. Murata?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
It's great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, yes. So maybe if you want to start off just by talking a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. This is David Murata. I'm president of Murata Wealth Management, and we help families organize their finances to meet their goals. I also write a weekly financial column, Murata on Money, that's published online and in newspapers around the country, including the Daily Progress here in Charlottesville.
And then, of course, also you're a political columnist for the Daily Progress.
Yes.
For listeners who are interested in checking out Mr. Murata's columns, I encourage you to look at his website, emurata.com, which is spelled E-M-A-R-O-T-T-A.com. So, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. And the column's based upon two principles. One is that it's the responsibility of every citizen to take care of themselves and their family, and that's the personal finance piece. And then second, it's the responsibility of government to leave people unencumbered so that they can take care of their families, and that's sort of the public policy piece.
Right, so and that's for the listeners, that's the approach we're going to take in the show today. Is Mr. Murata is going to talk about, in terms of your personal finances, what you can do to secure firm financial footing for yourself in the future. But he's also going to talk about the governmental side and how that will be affecting personal portfolios. So maybe if you want to start out by talking a little bit about taxation, tax rates and their effect now and how they're going to change in the future.
Yeah, usually the most important piece in anyone's finances is living well within their means, saving and investing in the markets. That's the engine of growth by which your money will grow at a rate faster than inflation so that you can actually increase your buying power. But this year is an exceptional year because of the recent legislative changes that are coming along. Tax management, it turns out, is going to be one of the most important pieces for personal finances. At the end of 2010, the Bush tax cuts are going to expire, which will be a significant increase in taxes. And the Congress doesn't have to do anything. That legislation was put in place with an expiration date. The expiration date is 2010. And in 2011, we revert back to the pre-Bush tax cut taxation rates.
And will you explain what those are a little bit, like the numbers? Do you mind telling the listeners what the numbers are associated with that?
Yeah, there's a whole host of different changes. They affect every single level because in the Bush tax cuts, every single level got a tax decrease. So at the end of this year, every single level of taxation will get a tax increase. The top marginal rate, which is currently the top marginal federal rate, which is currently at 35%, is going back to 39.5%. So that's a 5% increase. The rate of capital gains taxes, which is currently at 15%, is going back to 20%. And then on top of that, there's an extra, I think it's something like 3.8% at the top marginal rate that Obama has put on to help pay for the medical package that just passed. So that means if you're in the top marginal rate, your taxation rate on capital gains is going from 15% almost up to 25%. It's 23.8 or something like that. So the wave of taxation that's going to hit at the end of 2010 is huge. I call it a tax tsunami. And for people who are the most productive people in society, their top marginal rate when you add all the taxes together could be going from somewhere around 42% all the way up to 60 or 62%, which is a huge taxation rate.
Does that include state as well?
Yeah, that includes FICA, Social Security, an average state taxation rate, the whole buckets together.
Right.
And that doesn't factor in all of the taxation that's been put into the medical bill. It's still difficult to analyze all the taxes that are coming down in what year they're going to hit. But we know at the end of 2010, the Bush tax cuts expire, and some of the taxes begin to roll in. And so it's at least going up by something around that, depending upon exactly which legislation is being enacted.
Right.
So that's a huge taxation rate. And most people think, it doesn't matter, we're just taxing the rich. The rich have plenty of money. About 40% of our clients are small business owners. And a small business owner, we get to see into their finances quite clearly. And small business owners are the ones who have the bullseye painted on their foreheads. They are making an adjusted gross income of over $250,000. But most people have no idea what it looks like to have an adjusted gross income over $250,000. So you take a typical small business owner, anything they make in their businesses flows onto their personal taxes. So if they make $250,000, they may not have any savings, and they're going to get taxed at a rate that's going from maybe 42% up to 62%. Whereas if you look at someone like Warren Buffett, who has billions and billions of dollars, his effective tax rate is at about 17%, because we don't tax the wealthy in this country, we tax the productive. And it doesn't matter how much money you have, we tax income, which is productivity. So a small business owner making $250,000, they might pay $100,000 or $120,000 in taxes. They might take a very modest salary of $50,000 or $70,000, and they may be trying to roll the rest of it into business growth. And it doesn't matter if you make profit, it doesn't matter that you roll it back into your company, you still get taxed on it as a small business owner. And so getting a small business to grow to a slightly larger small business or a medium-sized business requires the government taking half and the other half you're putting back into the business. Very difficult to grow that way. And most of the small business owners we know are just stocking up cash, because they know that while this year they might have paid $100,000 or $120,000 in taxes, they know that next year they're going to pay $140,000 to $160,000 in taxes. And those extra taxes, which might have gone to hire people or to expand their businesses, is simply going to stockpile to pay the taxes for next year, which are going to be huge.
Right. And, I mean, of course, as you touched on, these sort of tax rates make it almost impossible to grow your business and engage in capital formation.
It is very difficult. And every study shows that small businesses are responsible for 110% of job growth, and large businesses are responsible for negative 10% job consolidation. And so if you don't have small business growth, you basically don't have job growth.
And so now break down those percentages for us. Small businesses are responsible for 110% of job growth?
Yes, and large businesses actually are responsible for 10% job shrinkage as they consolidate. And the way it works is that large businesses are always trying to become more efficient. That's how they grow their bottom line, whereas small businesses are actually trying to expand. So small businesses are increasing their product line, they're increasing their locations, they're growing the number of staff they have, and large businesses are laying people off, consolidating, reducing the number of offices, getting economies of scale, so they're actually cutting back on the workforce. So on average, large businesses who quite honestly get too many of the perks of government because they can, because no small business owner can lobby Congress, but every large business owner does. And so Congress hands out goods to people who are actually shrinking the economy, and they heap all the taxation on the people who are actually expanding the economy and jobs.
Now, of course, one of the arguments the government makes is that through this taxation, the government will in turn be able to itself create jobs. Will you talk a little bit about the fallacies behind that sort of reasoning?
Yeah, but you can't increase jobs by government spending, because the government has to take money away from one group and give it to another group, and that doesn't create a job. So recently we've had the case where the federal government is increasing jobs while the private sector is decreasing jobs, and that's a complete net negative. If you take money away from small business owners, they're the only ones who increase jobs. Government spending at best is efficient and is not messing up the markets. I've actually never seen a case where government spending is efficient and not messing up the markets. It's almost always inefficient, and it takes $100,000 away from a small business owner who might have hired a couple of people. It spends that on a very temporary spending for a project that couldn't have gotten funding in the private sector because it doesn't pay for itself, and then it takes those jobs away from real job expansion. Additionally, they just came out with a study that showed that the average worker in the private sector earns $50,000, and the average worker in the federal government earns $70,000 and has better benefits, more job security, and is a bigger drain on the economy. So the exact same jobs in the federal sector are now paying better than they are in the private sector, and we're at the point at which there's too many people in the federal sector whose livelihood depends upon federal spending, and they're not willing to vote themselves a pay cut.
Right. I actually have seen that once you take into account all the benefits, average federal employee compensation is close to $120,000. And of course, in terms of these redistribution schemes, you end up having a bureaucrat spend money to try to create a job rather than an entrepreneur. So it's obviously being spent less efficiently. Go ahead.
Well, and then you have in the private sector, when people are spending their dollars, they get exactly what they want, and they don't have to spend. They don't have to spend a dollar they don't want to spend. It's all voluntary. In the federal government, you get forced down your throat what you're going to spend it on. So, in the private sector, if just take color of car, if 51% of the people want blue cars and 49% want red cars, you get 51% get blue cars and 49% get red cars. In the federal government, everything gets standardized to a one-size-fits-all, and if 51% want blue cars, well, then, by God, all 100% will get blue cars. And so it's a very inefficient way of giving people what they don't want and spending other people's money to subsidize desires which are not strong enough for them to have spent their own money.
Right. And you touched on this a moment ago, about how when you expand the federal employee system like this, you end up having constituents who are unwilling to vote to cut their own jobs. So people in the government who are supposed to serve us, they have vested interests that are directly opposed to the interests of the taxpaying citizens.
Yeah, I think it was Milton Friedman who talked about he wrote an article back in the 1970s, I think 1977, he wrote an article called "The Fragility of Freedom at 60%. And he said when you get 60% of their people, 60% of the people in the country receiving some method, some measure of their livelihood through the government means, it shuts down free speech, it shuts down the ability of freedom, it shuts down the ability for people to do and work as they please. And you see that now in the government, that no one really wants to cross the government and speak out against them who's a CEO of a company, because they know that the government is able to, with a stroke of the pen, reduce their company's profits by billions of dollars. And so whenever you give government that much control and that much power, you're going to have special interests lobbying for what they want, corruption, and retribution by the federal government. And it's inevitable. It's not just that you could do it otherwise. It's inevitable that when that amount of power gets centralized, it will necessarily become corrupt. Whereas in the private market, there is no power. The same power in the private market is distributed among a lot of different people. And if someone's trying to lobby, if the blue paint lobby is trying to lobby that all cars should be blue paint, they can't move 51% very far. They can't move it to 100% and force that decision on everyone else. And so everyone has the ability to choose what they want. And so a distributed power like that is much less than a centralized power in the federal government. And we would have a lot less battles, and we would be a lot less polarized, or a lot less polarized in this country if we went to more freedom and more free choice. But the minute you give that power to the federal government, we're going to fight over should there be X in the government, because there's so much at stake and we don't get to choose. The choosing in the free market is 100%. The choosing is so diluted in the political system as to almost be meaningless.
Right. You talked about lobbying a moment ago, and a lot of people complain about lobbying and its effect on the government. But it seems like the root of the problem really is government's willingness to interfere in the economic sphere. And once you admit that it will do that, lobbying is just a natural consequence.
Exactly. If you reduce the power of government, you reduce the negative effect of lobbying. And the minute you start putting things in the federal government, like healthcare, for example, the minute you start putting things like that in the federal government, then everyone has their pet disease that they want to see covered by the federal government. And all it takes is a very, very small minority to actually push through a very major effect on everyone else. Because something that's specialized, like a disease that hits 5% of the population, or maybe even 1% of the population, there's a very small group that has a very high interest in seeing that included in all the packages. But for the general populace, it might only mean a dollar or two extra every month or every day or something like that, and so it's not worth our time to lobby. So special interests have more sway in the government because it's worth their while, and general interests are simply disregarded. And when you get enough general interest being disregarded, you get a huge and bloated federal government, and then you start losing freedoms.
I think it's also interesting, as you pointed out, the chilling effect that economic control has on other realms of liberty. A lot of liberals seem to think that you can give over economic control to the government without sacrificing civil liberties, but obviously that's not the case.
No, if you just look at freedom of speech, that ought to be enough to show you that people really can't speak out against the government if the government is holding them by the purse strings and able to make their life miserable. You saw an example of it recently when you had the federal government first take over GM, then take money away from all the bondholders and give it to the unions of GM, then implement a cash for clunkers scheme that simply gave away thousands and thousands of dollars to boost car sales, and then called Toyota in for hearings to demonize Toyota because it wasn't GM, when GM has had so many different problems and recalls that somehow they finally got Toyota on one, and they called them in and humiliated them to try to reduce their sales. It's amazing to see that kind of intervention in the private markets, and Toyota had to come in and they had to say all the right things because they knew that if they didn't say the right things and if they actually just called them to account for what they were really doing, it would be a battle in which they would lose even more than they were going to lose. And so that kind of intervention in the free markets is really more of fascism than it is of socialism. It is a collusion between the federal government owning private enterprises and then using the federal government legislation to boost the private enterprise that they happen to own. And that kind of collusion it's like having a soccer game and then all of a sudden the referee comes on and starts playing on the field. Well, you can guarantee that the two teams are going to lose and the referees are going to win almost no matter how hard they try or how good they are.
I think that's a failure of a lot of people to see the difference between, obviously, what we're getting at is capitalism versus corporatism.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that difference?
Any other elaboration? I mean, you've seen item after item after item. You see, for example, in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the federal government gave itself powers to have the full backing of the United States of America, and to be able to offer rates that were lower than any other bank. And at this point, all house lending basically has to flow through their federal government. They have a lock and a monopoly on that will be forever. And in the midst of all of that, then they started using it for political means. So rather than just lending to the people who could afford it, they had the Community Reinvestment Act, in which they required banks to lend to people who couldn't afford it, and then made all the legislation to allow that to be securitized, and basically brought about the financial crisis. It's crazy when you have the very people who are responsible for the financial crisis then saying, well, gosh, now we've got work to do. We better step in and take this over and regulate it all because somehow the private markets can't handle it. The people who caused the crisis sometimes on purpose, because without a crisis you can't extend the power that you have into various areas of the market. And so you have this crisis, and then we will solve the crisis. And at this point, they're actually trying, it looks to me like the legislation for healthcare, they're actually trying to cause crisis on the healthcare side in order that they might be the ones who, in 5 or 10 years, will be the only ones able to step in and alleviate the problem.
As Rahm Emanuel said right after it hit, you should never let a good crisis go to waste.
That's exactly right. That was one of the most telling quotes, and anyone who heard that and understood it, there is absolutely no reason why you should be voting to give more power to the federal government. We need to actually dismantle some of the power of the federal government and return that power in the form of empowering citizens to make their own choices. Well, one of the craziest things in the healthcare legislation is now if you pay a fine, I think the fine is like $900. If you pay the fine, then you don't need to have health care. And since they can't exclude you for pre-existing conditions, you can pay the $900 fine. And then if you need heart surgery tomorrow, you can sign up to immediately get health care, and they can't deny you. Whereas before, you might have gotten insurance because who knows when you're going to need it. And when you need it, you can't get a pre-existing condition covered. Now it will actually drop people out of the healthcare system. I'll just pay my $900 fine, and then when I need it, I can get millions of dollars in coverage simply because they can't now exclude me for a pre-existing condition.
Oh, wow.
There is no insurance company who will be able to survive that legislation. It will tear the insurance companies apart. There's no way that they can handle it. It's the exact opposite of insurance because the insurance companies can't know an adverse selection like that, where only the people who need heart surgery are going to sign up. Because that means that every insurance company will now go under, the only insurance company left is going to be the federal government. And it's a way for them to destroy the competition through legislation, which will enact a crisis in 5 or 10 years, and then they'll be able to step in and say, well, I know, what we really need to do is to have universal coverage only through the federal government and consolidate all of that risk, i.e. power, in the hands of the federal government. And it's the exact opposite of what we need.
Yeah, that's pretty bleak. Of course, we do see this pattern again and again of the government perpetuating a crisis and then saying more government power is what's necessary to solve it.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is if you look at the political forces today, I do believe in the fickleness of the American voter. And I am cautiously optimistic that the American voter has said enough of both parties. What we really need is smaller federal government, smaller government, and we need to elect people who will do that. I don't know what's going on in the Democratic Party. It looks to me like there's very few people in the Democratic Party who are willing to stand up for that kind of freedom. In the Republican Party, there's a battle right now between previous Republican administrations who did stuff that was, I mean, the only thing worse than the Republicans have been the Democrats. I mean, the Republicans put in Medicare Part D, which is one of the worst entitlements until the recent legislation. The recent legislation is probably the worst legislation in the last 75 years and has set the tone for a complete socialization of medicine in this country. But it seems to me that there is a battle going on right now, and the Tea Party and libertarian efforts is saying, look, we need smaller government, and if you're not the people who can do that, we're not going to support you and vote for you. So hopefully, in the upcoming elections, there will be a real battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party, and maybe if enough libertarian Democrats and libertarian Republicans get together, we can get some libertarian candidates in that will reduce the size of government and increase freedoms.
Do you think that that is going to be an effective way to combat the growth of the federal government? Do you think that merely voting them out is sufficient? Are there structural changes that maybe need to be made in terms of our system?
You know, that's a great question. But I actually think that the structure of our country is founded on very good principles in the Constitution. But the Constitution, unfortunately, the Constitution is just dry ink on paper. It can be disregarded, it can be misunderstood, and historically has been, I think, misunderstood. If you were to take the Founding Fathers today, they'd probably be buying guns and saying it's time for another revolution. And there's no way to combat legal plunder by legal means. And so there's a sense in which they could be right. We could be ready for something like that. I think it was the law written back in 1850 that talked about legal plunder, and there's no way to fight it by legal means because it's legal. And I read an article recently by the ACLU in which they said, look, it's easier to get 7 judges elected than it is a few hundred congressmen or state legislators. And so let's just go for the court system because the courts can decide whatever they want, and they can decide, oh, no, the Commerce Clause says we can force everybody to buy whatever we want, and the Commerce Clause can say that we can regulate ponds because geese fly over them, and the Commerce Clause says. So unfortunately, we have a great structural format in the Constitution. It's just we've drifted so far from the founders' intent on the Constitution that we need to pull it back. So I actually like the structure of our country. If we had 50 different experiments in taxation, then people could move between states and get the experiment that they wanted to be a part of. That would be a tremendous amount of freedom. But because we have the federal government, you can't escape it.
Right. I agree. Enumerated powers, I think, are the most disregarded thing of the Constitution. But even in terms of adding to the Constitution something more explicit, I think one of the problems you run into the Constitution is that it's so vague, because you have enumerated powers on one hand, and then you have the welfare clause on the other hand. Could maybe a requirement for a federal balanced budget, an amendment like that, would that be beneficial, do you think?
You know, anytime you put more dried ink on paper, you still have to have legislature that's going to abide by it. But I do think that the conversation within the country is very important, and that is, what percentage of our gross domestic product do you think the government should take up? So, you know, every year we look at Tax Freedom Day or we look at Spending Freedom Day to see what amount of the federal government, what percentage of the gross domestic product is being eaten up by the federal government. And I think there ought to be some limit on that. But the problem is we've got so many entitlement programs, it's very difficult, unless you dismantle the entitlement programs, to get anything like a balanced budget. And you could get something like a balanced budget, but you might end up having so much in taxation as to make it not worthwhile. So it's difficult to know, so long as spending is out of control on the federal government, and so long as we keep enacting more entitlement programs on the federal government, it's very difficult to undo this. So we just need to dismantle more of the federal government.
Right. You talked about national spending as a percentage of GDP. Will you talk a little bit about the numbers? How that has changed?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure what the latest numbers are, and you may have them at your fingertips, because this year's spending is so out of control. I think this year's spending is close to, I don't remember, but it's much, much higher than it ought to be. I want to say 70%, but I don't know if that number is correct. So spending this year is absolutely ridiculous. And Obama has pledged to reduce the amount we're adding to the deficit, but he based it all on this year's numbers, which is ridiculous. So if this year is 3 times what last year was in terms of spending deficit, he's then promised to reduce the 3 times number by 10% over the next 3 years. That's absolutely ridiculous.
It is. That you can
play with those kinds of numbers. And Obama has been one of the presidents that has found a way to tell the most misleading truths possible. So everything he says you can kind of support in some strange way, but to anyone who's listening, they would call it an out-and-out lie. And the media doesn't seem to call him on any of it. They just seem to let it all pass and talk about it as though they're just reading the White House press releases.
Right. Yes, it's very disingenuous the way he presents some of the truths. Back to taxation, we strayed a bit. In terms of the recession, what do you foresee the effects of this taxation having regarding our recovery?
I'm fairly certain that it will make the recovery much slower. Gross domestic product growth in the United States historically has been at 6.5%. And that we've been the engine of growth because we've been the engine of freedom. I think I saw your article, I did one as well, on the fact that for the first time in the Heritage Foundation's history of doing economic freedom, the United States fell out of the free category into the mostly free category. That's just a disgrace, and it's difficult to imagine how we could manage that. So, in the gross domestic product growth being at 6.5% is now going to be probably slowing to European levels, and European levels are closer to 3% rather than 6.5%. So, I would expect that the United States would go to a more of a European model, and therefore not have as good gross domestic product growth as it has.
And this is one of the problems with this sort of thing, is that you see the benefits of the government program, you see people getting insurance, but you don't ever see the growth that you missed out on. So it's much easier for the government to trumpet the benefits that it's promoting, whereas people who are arguing for the free market can't point to the growth that never happened.
Yeah, the unintended consequences or the lost opportunity costs are completely missed. And that's one of the reasons why it's difficult as an economist or as a libertarian to explain the unintended consequences, because they don't necessarily fit in a soundbite. They have to be aggregated long enough for them to begin to see the effects. So if I told you, you're gonna be a dollar is gonna be taken away from you every single day, it's very difficult for you to say, oh, a dollar a day, that means nothing. But we know from the financial planning world that if I take a dollar away from you today, that's the equivalent of 100. If you're in your 20s and I take a dollar away from you today, just $1, that's the equivalent of $100 in your retirement account. And if I take away a dollar a day throughout your entire working career, that's the equivalent of $100,000 in your retirement account. And so a dollar a day really makes a huge difference in terms of your retirement. Every single person in America ought to be retiring as a multimillionaire based upon Social Security. And yet now, if you're just living off of Social Security, you have a very, very meager lifestyle. So you have this this effect that you don't necessarily see because you miss the opportunity costs. Social Security is the worst legislation we've ever had. It's impoverished our seniors tremendously. And the same thing's going to happen with health care, only it's going to impoverish our health care system.
Now, in terms of your clients, what are you counseling them to do? I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the Roth IRA and how that can be used to combat these tax rates.
Yeah, because taxes are going to go up so much on small business owners or anyone who earns over $100,000 a year, we have suggested for most of our clients that they take the money that's in their IRAs. This is the first year that you can do a Roth conversion even if you make over $100,000. So it's the first year it's been available. We suggest that they take their IRAs and convert them to Roth IRAs. Go ahead and pay the tax this year at the last year of the Bush tax cuts. And then the money will be in a Roth IRA, and assuming that the government holds all of its promises true, is never taxed again.
Will you talk about the difference?
With an IRA, you put the money in before tax, it grows, and then when you take it out, you get taxed on it. With a Roth IRA, you put the money in after taxes, it grows, and there's no tax on the growth, and there's no tax when you take it out.
Right. Yes, I just wanted you to elaborate on that difference a little bit between a Roth. I liked your analogy in your article about taxing the oak and taxing the acorn.
Yeah, if you pay money on the Acorn, that's a Roth IRA, and then it grows tax free. If you pay tax on the Oak, that's like a traditional IRA. And there have been some people, in fact, most people, when they put the money in and it was in an IRA or a 401k, they put the money in when they were young and their tax rates were very low. And now when they're retiring, they're taking it out and they're older and their tax rate is much higher and tax rates have gone up. So they've actually lost money by putting money into an IRA or a 401k because they got very little tax break when they were in a low tax bracket. And now that they're rich, they're taking it out and they're getting socked with taxes because they're in a much higher tax bracket. So we recommend Roth IRAs for all of our younger clients, and now we're recommending Roth IRAs and Roth conversions for all of our clients. Additionally, there's another technique that I'll just mention, and then I'll refer people back to our website. But there's a Roth segregation account, which is what you do is this. Let's say I've got $1 million in my traditional IRA. I go ahead and I convert $1 million because I'm in the highest tax bracket anyway, and I can get it all at the 35% rate Bush tax cuts. But instead of converting all of my $1 million into one account, I convert my $1 million into five separate $200,000 accounts, and I invest them all differently. I invest one in bonds and one in U.S. stocks and one in foreign stocks and one in emerging markets and one in hard asset stocks. And then I let them all run for the entire year. I don't have to pay any tax until April of 2011. And when April of 2011 comes around, if I want, the IRS allows me to unconvert, recharacterize any of the accounts I want. And so long as I have kept them in separate accounts, I can decide which ones I want to keep and which ones I want to recharacterize and unconvert. And those I don't have to pay tax on. So if one of my $200,000 accounts has gone up to $400,000, I'll keep that one. And if one of my $200,000 accounts has gone down and now it's only worth $150,000, I'll recharacterize it and won't pay any tax on it. So I only have to pay tax on the $200,000 that was converted, but then I get to keep whatever has been running after an entire year. That's called a Roth recharacterization and a Roth segregation account. And there's some articles on our website about Roth segregation accounts. And again, the website is www.emarotta.com, emarotta.com.
All right, for listeners just tuning in, you're listening to Libertarian Talk Radio with Austin Rayner, and our guest today is David Marotta, who's a financial planner and also a columnist. So go ahead.
And I was going to say, by doing this Roth segregation, it's kind of like betting on the horse race after the horse race is over. You can decide whether you want to keep a Roth conversion or not. And there's no downside. If you convert $1 million today, a year from now you can decide to keep it all or recharacterize it all, and you haven't lost any of your options. So it's a tremendous benefit. And one of the first questions I always get asked is this legal? And you have to understand, first of all, yes, it's legal. People do this all the time. We did it for our clients. But what you have is when you have an incredibly complex federal bureaucracy of tax code, there's no morality to the tax code. If the tax code says you get a tax deduction for standing on your left foot for an hour, you're going to look around and see a lot of people who are savvy about taxes standing on their left foot for an hour. And so what we call tax loopholes, I never like to think of them as tax loopholes. I think I define a tax loophole is when the government hasn't tied you down with so much red tape as to have taken away all of your free will. In other words, they've still given you some choices and ways of avoiding huge taxations and tax tsunamis. So, yes, there's all kinds of things you can do in the tax code, and one of the crazy things is that we can earn more money sometimes for our clients by tax management than we can by actually trying to figure out how to save and invest the money the right way. And that's not always the case. That's only the case when the federal government is doing crazy things in taxation, which unfortunately, over the last couple of years, has been huge. The federal government has done all kinds of crazy things in taxation and made so much complexity, and with complexity, there's an opportunity to do tax management.
Right. Very good. Well, I'm glad to have that perspective. That's definitely a practical application in response to some of the things that the government's doing. I wanted you to talk a little bit about, we've only got 20 minutes left, about inflation and the insidious effects of inflation, which I think a lot of people are ignorant about the fact that inflation is really just a tax, a hidden tax.
It is. It's a tax on wealth that you keep in dollars. And if you were to have invested, just for some perspective, if you were to have invested $1 in gold 200 years ago, it would be worth about a dollar's worth of gold today, maybe $1.07 or something like that. Gold holds its value, and it's one of those constants. It used to be that our currency was denominated in gold as well, but we've long since lost that. If you were to have had $1 200 years ago and you adjust for inflation, that dollar is now worth about 7 cents in its buying power. So the dollar used to be much, much stronger. A dollar 200 years ago could buy a lot. A dollar today can buy almost nothing.
And that's even adjusted for inflation, or the government reported inflation.
That's correct. That's adjusted for just government reported inflation. It turns out that the government, since around about 1996, has been underreporting inflation significantly. And I wrote a series of columns on this, and I waited until the effects were obvious before I wrote the columns, because when you say the government is lying about inflation numbers, you just sound like Mel Gibson at the opening of Conspiracy Theory movie, where he's mumbling all these weird conspiracy theories. And what's interesting is he sounds like a crazy man at the beginning of the movie, and then as the movie goes on, you find out that many of the things he's mumbling about are true. And I just had to wait long enough into the government underreporting inflation for it to be obvious that the government was underreporting inflation, even though economists talk about this all the time. And the way the government underreports inflation, back in 1996, they said, hey, we're reporting inflation too high. Let's figure out if we can report it lower and see if we can make it more accurate. But the way they made it more accurate is crazy. First, they said, hey, you bought a computer last year and it cost you $3,000. You bought a computer this year and it cost you $3,000. But the computer this year is faster and has more memory. In fact, it's 20% faster and has 20% more memory. So we're going to count that as a 20% deflation in the economy. And we're going to take that out of the inflation numbers. Now, that's not deflation. That is simply technological advances. And if you don't count, if you take that out of inflation, what you're taking out is any technological advance. And since you're taking those out of inflation, what that means is for your senior citizens who are on Social Security, you're not giving them the cost of living that they deserve. In fact, last year there was zero cost of living, even though cost of living actually probably went up for seniors because inflation was actually negative last year. So what that means is you leave seniors living Amish lives in a digital age. They don't get any technological advances in their cost of living. They can't afford the latest technology, and therefore they have to live with older and older technology. Another one that they do is called, and that particular technique that they use in computing inflation is called the hedonic deprecator, meaning we're going to deprecate inflation because you get more hedonism out of this computer than you got out of the computer last year. Another one they use is called creative substitution. If the cost of beef goes up, you would think that would be inflation. But all they say is, well, we're just going to say that more people, when the cost of beef goes up, they substitute for cheaper chicken. And when the cost of chicken goes up, they substitute for pork. And when the cost of pork goes up, they all become vegetarians. And so they just keep moving around what they do, and it ends up being a downward spiral of creative substitution, and they factor it in month by month, so they never really actually get the full inflation when meat prices go up. These techniques, this hedonic deprecator and this creative substitution, had they been used at Enron, the people who used them would have gone to jail for that kind of creative accounting. But because they're used by the federal government, there's absolutely no... There's no recourse, if you will. And interestingly enough, both the Republicans and the Democrats like this technique. It came about under the Clinton years, but Bush didn't undo it. Why? Well, Clinton liked it because it helped him show a balanced budget by keeping the cost of living for these entitlement programs down. Bush liked it because it helped reduce the entitlement programs. And so both Republicans and Democrats actually like this technique of underreporting inflation. And additionally, it allows the federal government to have huge inflation and then reduce the official amounts that inflation is so it doesn't look like they have huge inflation.
Yeah, wow. So, I have studied it a bit, and I didn't have any idea that the government was engaged in that sort of manipulation of the numbers.
Yeah, there's a couple of sites on the web that compute inflation the old way. They say inflation has, throughout the time period, always been underreported by at least 2%. So if you can imagine, from 1996 until now, it's 15 years of being underreported by 2%. It's like we've given our seniors a 30% reduction in their Social Security benefits from over the last 15 years. Additionally, it looks like inflation is running maybe at this point 5% or so higher than the official numbers, because the official numbers aren't really computing what it really costs to do cost of living. They tend to factor out things. Anything that's gone up a lot, they always factor it out before they report it on the news. So sometimes energy is factored out, sometimes other things.
And then other effects of this, we have GDP growth according to the government, but with that large of a discrepancy in inflation, growth is probably negative.
It has been over the last couple of years. Growth has been, we've been in more of a recession, but because we have low inflation numbers, it doesn't look like we've been in a recession as long. Additionally, it really eats away at wealth. A lot of people who come to us, a lot of prospective clients who come to us say, I just want to put my money someplace safe. So I want to put my, we've had all this financial trouble. I want to put my money someplace safe. How about if we put it in treasury bills or CDs or something like that? Well, it turns out dollars, anything denominated in dollars like treasury bills or CDs, has probably been the riskiest place to have put money since 1999 over the last decade, because you've lost your buying power and you haven't kept up with the real inflation that's been eating away at it. So at this point, if I had a choice between putting all of my money in emerging markets or putting all of my money in cash or CDs, I would definitely put all of my money in emerging markets first. Even though it bounces around a lot, at least it has an overall positive return over any longer period of time. So a lot of people think cash is safe. Cash is not a safe place, and you need to have your money spread out among a lot of different categories. We use six different asset classes, and three of them are protected against a falling dollar. Foreign bonds, because they're denominated in a foreign dollar currency, and the U.S., if it's going down, if you have a dropping dollar in terms of its value, you'll get a boost from foreign currencies, especially foreign currencies outside of the euro, which is also having troubles. So sometimes it's something like emerging market bonds that I think is actually a safe place, because the emerging markets can't devalue their currencies as easy. They don't have an active Fed that way. Foreign stocks, which are also denominated in foreign currencies, and then hard asset stocks, which will end up having a hard asset underneath them that holds its value. So you can imagine a gold mining company, for example, and if it takes them a certain, this is an old example, but if it took them $290 an ounce to get gold out of the ground and gold was selling at $300 an ounce, all it took was gold going from 300 to 310 and their profits doubled. So if they make a $10 an ounce profit, this goes up by $10, and now they make a $20 an ounce profit. So anything that has an underlying hard asset, like gold, oil, real estate investment trusts, even water or timber, those all have an underlying asset, will help protect against a falling dollar. So we like to make sure that half of our clients' portfolio is invested to protect them from a falling dollar.
I see. That's interesting. Yes, because in an inflationary scenario, dollars just sitting in the bank are just losing value day by day. What are the effects of inflation on overall economic growth and economic stability?
Inflation means that very few people would want to lend money on an inflationary period, but they'd want to borrow money, so it ends up leveraging more. Because if you can borrow dollars today and buy gold, then you can pay it. You can sell the gold later and pay it back with a lot more dollars later. So it ends up meaning that corporations almost have to leverage, or they have to invest in something that's going to hold its value against the dollar. But the biggest thing is that inflation means it's not good to hold on to anything for any period of time, and so it ends up being a tax on simply having capital. So it also has that same effect on every citizen. The savings rate in America is low, partly because we have inflation. Who wants to save a dollar when you know that that dollar 5 years from now isn't going to be worth as much? Why not simply borrow on credit? And now if I can max out my credit card, I can pay it back with cheaper dollars later. And so what it turns a country from a saving and investing and capital country into a spending, leveraged, deficit company with debt. And that's insidious. One of the 10 items in the Heritage Foundation's economic freedom is a stable currency. And if a government can offer its populace a stable currency, then the government has a better chance of promoting economic growth and economic activity. But if you have a destabilized currency, then people really don't want to engage in the economy because they don't want to change things into dollars that are losing their value by the day. They want to keep it in something else that actually has value and will hold its value.
And then as you touched on in terms of promoting borrowing rather than saving, that's one way that we get bubbles is the interest rates, which are supposed to reflect the level of saving and therefore constrain the level of borrowing and investment, are thrown all askew by government intervention in injecting liquidity into banks, which is something the Federal Reserve has done heavily.
Yes, and the Federal Reserve right now is holding interest rates artificially low. So as they hold it artificially low, the banks can get free money, and then they can loan it out at a very low interest rate and almost have a guarantee of making money. But at the same time, what they're doing is they're increasing the leveraging that all of our financial institutions have, and that's actually what got us in trouble in the first place. It would have been much better, rather than all the bailouts of banks, would have been for every bank that was leveraged, just let them go under. I don't know about where you live, but where I live, if half of the banks went out of business, we'd still have too many banks in town. and the banks that got punished in this whole deal were the banks that were actually doing what they were supposed to be doing. Any bank that was not highly leveraged and not lending money to the wrong people were being frugal. They weren't making as much money during the leverage times, but they were being responsible. And in this whole process, they got punished, and the billions in terms of bailouts that the banks got who were doing the wrong thing, they didn't get punished. They got rewarded. And so I would have loved to have seen just all the banks that were doing what they shouldn't be doing to simply have gone under. I don't think it would have hurt the economy much at all. Everyone thought that Enron was too big to fail. Who even remembered Enron a couple of years after it had gone under? It was like, yeah, well, we've recovered from that. There was no long-term impact. And you mentioned the fact that I'm a columnist. My very first column back in 2002, I co-authored with my father, who's a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution. And the title was, Will the U.S. Go the Way of Japan? Because at that point, Japan had this huge run-up in the stock market and then a burst. We'd had a burst of the tech bubble as well. And we said, no, the U.S. won't go the way of Japan, because when we have an Enron, we let it go under. When Japan has an Enron, they call it too big to fail, they bail it out, and it's a drag on their economy for the next decade. And hooray for American capitalism, Enron going under won't even be remembered in another couple of years. And it wasn't. Then they called all the banks too big to fail, and they bailed them out, and we're going to hear about that for the next decade, how they saved all these banks, and they saved us from a financial ruin, and they saved us from everything else, and aren't we glad we have the federal government to save us from all of this stuff, when in fact, had all those banks gone under, I don't think you and I would have felt the effect at all. We would have felt the recovery a lot faster.
And then by bailing out the banks, you encourage the type of behavior that led those banks to get in trouble in the first place. By subsidizing it,
yes,
you get more of it.
Yes, exactly. And that kind of destabilization, anytime you try to stabilize one industry and make sure that people in that industry can't fail, you destabilize every other industry slightly. And you can afford to do that sometimes, but if you do it too many times, you'll have all kinds of failures. And so what you're going to find is because they have tried to stabilize the banking industry and make sure no one can fail in that, they've destabilized all the small businesses and made it much more likely for them to fail. Whereas had they let them go under, they would have strengthened every other industry who wouldn't have felt the effects as much as they're feeling them right now.
I think that the analogy you draw between the U.S. and Japan is interesting because, of course, Japan has been mired in economic malaise basically for decades now, and we're taking a lot of the same steps that they took.
Yes. Yes, we're hastening our way toward the waterfall where other countries are already going over it and can't seem to find their way back out, and we seem to be trying to catch up with them. So we will find ourselves like Japan or like Greece in our monetary policies that we're headed on now, unless we can find the moral strength and the political strength to say we want less government and we mean it, and we will vote out of office anyone who's trying to enlarge the federal government on the backs of us in the private sector.
We've only got a couple more minutes, Mr. Murata. Is there anything you would like to say in conclusion?
I will say that it's interesting to me how important personal financial planning is. In every case where the federal government is trying to save us, they're often trying to save us from ourselves, whereas a little bit of planning and a little bit of smarts ends up producing a lot more good doing your own financial planning and taking your own responsibility for your finances. In terms of health care, there's health savings accounts where you're insuring against disasters, so you have a very high deductible. And insurance really only belongs against disasters. What you want to insure against is a very unlikely event, not the first dollar spent. So a health savings account allows you to insure with a high deductible of, say, $5,000. If you get into financial trouble medically and you need all kinds of medical care, the maximum you'll ever pay is $5,000. That kind of coverage for a family of four is only about $330 here in Charlottesville, very reasonable amount, and then you pay out of pocket for the first $5,000. The reverse, which is what Obamacare is trying to do, is like having grocery store insurance, where every dollar spent in the grocery store is covered by insurance. If you do that, first, everyone will buy filet mignon. Then the insurance costs will go through the roof, and pretty soon the only thing you'll be able to get will be rotten meat. It's just inevitable that that's the way of doing it. That's not what insurance is for from a financial planning activity. So what I found is that families who are willing to take the time to get their finances together really end up having everything they need in their own hands to control and to be able to make sure that their finances will be successful and they'll meet their goals. There's very little that the federal government impacts our personal finances except the rate of taxation. And the rate of taxation is like a drag on everyone's finances, hurting them and making them less able to meet their own family's needs.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Everyone, this has been David Murata today. I encourage you to check out his website, emurata.com, which is spelled emarotta.com. for more articles and financial planning advice. So thank you, Mr. Murata.
Awesome. Thank you so much for what you do. I really appreciate your articles and your radio show.
Thank you. I enjoyed the interview. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
All right, everyone. Well, thanks for tuning in. That's all for today. I hope that you'll tune in next week at 4 o'clock for another edition of Libertarian Talk Radio. This is Austin Rayner signing off.